Chapter 25. Dwyer glanced down at the dry desert ground as the Sikorsky S-76 helicopter flew above northern Arizona. Miles away, to his left, he could see a snow-capped range of peaks. The view of the snow-covered mountains surprised him. Like most people who had never visited the state, Dwyer had been under the impression that the land would be an endless stretch of sand and cacti. Arizona, it now appeared, had a little of everything.
"How often does it snow here?" he asked the pilot through the headset.
"Those peaks are over near Flagstaff," the pilot said. "They receive enough to support a ski area. The tallest peak is Humphreys. It's over 12,000 feet."
"This was not what I expected," Dwyer admitted.
"Most people," the pilot said, "say the same thing."
The pilot had been a little reticent since first meeting Dwyer 2 hours ago in Phoenix. Dwyer couldn't blame him. He was certain that the higher-ups in charge of Arizona's Homeland Security had told the pilot nothing about Dwyer's position or the purpose of the trip. Most people preferred to have at least a vague idea of their mission.
"We're flying to the crater so I can remove some rock samples," Dwyer said, "to take to a lab for testing."
"That's all?"
the pilot said, visibly relaxing.
"Yep,"
Dwyer answered.
"Sweet," the pilot said, "because you can't believe some of the assignments I've had lately. I almost hate to come to work some days."
"I'll bet. I've ended my shift in a chemical detox shower more than once," the pilot said. "Not my idea of a good day at the office."
"This should be a piece of cake," Dwyer assured him.
The revelation loosened the pilot's jaw, and he gave Dwyer a non-stop travelogue of the sights they were passing for the remainder of the flight. 20 minutes later, he pointed forward through the windshield.
"There she is!"
The meteor crater was a massive pockmark on the dusty terrain. Upon seeing the sight from the air, it was not difficult to imagine the force that would have been required to make such a deep penetration of the Earth's crust. It was like a giant had taken a huge ball-peen hammer and whacked the earth. The dust clouds after the impact must have been visible for months afterward. The edge of the crater, a pie-crust-like circle, loomed ahead.
"Which side, sir?"
the pilot asked. Dwyer scanned the ground.
"There," he said, "near that white pickup."
The pilot slowed the Sikorsky, then hovered, and sat her down smoothly.
"I was ordered to remain aboard," the pilot said, "and monitor the radio traffic."
After the pilot had gone through his shutdown procedure and the rotor blade had stopped, Dwyer climbed out and walked over to a man in a cowboy hat and boots standing off to the side. The man extended his hand, and Dwyer shook it firmly.
"Thanks for agreeing to help," Dwyer said.
"Shoot," the man said. "You don't turn down a request from the President of the United States. I'm glad to be able to help."
The man walked back to his pickup, reached into the bed and removed a few hand tools and a bucket, then handed Dwyer a shovel. Then he pointed over to the rim.
"I think what you're looking for is right over there."
Climbing over the ridge of spoil that rimmed the crater, the two men headed down the side 20 yards. The temperature grew hotter as they descended. The man in the cowboy hat stopped.
"This is the far edge of the crater," he noted,
wiping his brow with a bandana.
"It's always yielded the biggest chunks for me."
Dwyer glanced around, located a likely spot, and began digging with the shovel. At the same time that Dwyer started digging in Arizona, on the Oregon, in the sea off Iceland, it was decidedly colder. Below decks in his office, Michael Halpert was staring at a printout from his computer. Halpert had been hard at work for hours, and his eyes were burning from staring at the computer screen. Punching commands into the keyboard, Halpert brought up the mission file and stared at Cabrillo's notes again. Glancing at the printout again, he gathered his notes and walked to the control room.
"Richard," Hanley was saying as Halpert walked into the room, "have the Gulf Stream fueled and ready. I'll call you as soon as we need you."
Hanging up the phone, Hanley turned to Halpert.
"I take it you found something."
Halpert handed Hanley the document, and he read it quickly.
"It might be significant," Hanley said slowly. And it might not. That is a large sum that Hickman donated to the university. But he might have a habit of bequests like that.
I checked, Halpert said. He does, and they are all archaeologically based.
Interesting, Hanley said.
Plus, what the archaeologist said when he was dying, Halpert added, he bought and paid for the university.
I see what you're getting at, Hanley said. Plus, I thought it odd that Ackerman emailed Hickman first. He never even bothered to contact his department head with news of the find.
Maybe Hickman and Ackerman put that together, Halpert said. So Ackerman could be sure he grabbed the glory if anything was found, not his boss at the university.
That doesn't explain how Hickman could be sure Ackerman would even find something, Hanley said, or the chance that it would turn out to be a meteorite that was composed of iridium.
Maybe Hickman's involvement was altruistic at the beginning, Halpert said slowly. Ackerman makes his pitch, and Hickman has an interest in Eric the Red, so he decides to fund the expedition. Then, when the meteorite is discovered, he sees some opportunity.
We don't even know Hickman is involved, Hanley said. But if he is, what opportunity could make a rich man kill and risk all he has?
It's always one of two things, Halpert said, love or money.
The outline of the Faroe Islands was just coming into view through the haze when Hanley reached Cabrillo in the helicopter and explained what Halpert had discovered.
Damn, said Cabrillo. That's a twist out of left field.
What are your thoughts?
I say we go with it,
Hanley told him. The islands started growing in size in the windshield.
Has Dick arrived in London? Cabrillo asked.
I just spoke to him a few minutes ago,
Hanley said.
The jet was being refueled, then he was going to a hotel in London to wait for our call.
And the Challenger is standing by in Aberdeen?
On the ground,
Hanley said.
Fueled and waiting.
Then call Truett and his crew and tell them we need to have them fly to Las Vegas to see what they can find out about Hickman.
Great minds think alike,
Hanley said. Through the windshield of the helicopter, the port was becoming defined as Cabrillo disconnected and turned to Adams.
Let's get on the ground, old buddy.
Adams nodded and started his descent. The Free Enterprise was just outside the breakwater as she slowed and stopped. A small, open-deck fishing boat powered by a pair of 250-horsepower outboard motors pulled alongside. Pulling up next to the stairs that led to water level, the captain of the fishing boat slowed to a crawl, and one of his crew snagged the box from one of the Free Enterprise's deckhands. The crewman slid the box into a fish hold as the captain steered away from the larger vessel and hit the gas. Bouncing over the rough seas, the captain of the fishing boat steered his way into a small cove. The crewman climbed off the fishing boat and walked over to a road where a red van from a local package delivery service was waiting. 10 minutes later, the van had delivered the box to the airport. There it sat, awaiting transfer to a plane that was, at that instant, only a few miles away. Adams topped off both tanks and ran through his checklist. When that was finished, he made notes in the logbook. The helicopter had run fine on the trip in from the Oregon, so there was little to write, just flight times, weather conditions, and a note of a tiny vibration. Adams was finishing just as Cabrillo drove up next to the helicopter in a tiny rental car. He pulled up next to Adams and rolled down the window.
"Hey, boss," Adams said. "Did you get half off on the rental car?"
"It's called a smart car," Cabrillo said, brushing off the joke. "This was all they had. It was either this or walk. Now, bring the binoculars and locator and climb inside."
From under the helicopter's seat, Adams retrieved a pair of binoculars and the metal box that read the signals from the bugs sprinkled on the meteorite. Then he stepped over to the smart car and climbed into the passenger seat. The binoculars went on the floor. The metal box he kept on his lap. As Cabrillo pulled away, Adams began to tune in the signal from the bugs.
"The box says that the object's very close," Adams said.
Cabrillo crested a hill near the airport. The port was directly below. In the other lane, a red van approached, and the driver was flashing his headlights. Cabrillo realized he'd been driving on the right side of the road, American style, and he swerved over to the proper lane.
"Boss," Adams said, "we're right on it."
Cabrillo glanced over as the van passed. The driver gave a friendly wag of his finger at him for his poor driving, then continued on in the direction of the airport. Cabrillo glanced down the hill at a large ship just about to dock.
"There," he said, pointing. "That must be the vessel."
The vessel had the lines of a private yacht, but it was as black as a stealth bomber. Cabrillo could easily see the deckhands standing by with lines as the captain moved the ship over to the pier with the thrusters.
"The signal is fading," Adams said.
Cabrillo pulled over to the side of the road and watched the yacht through the binoculars as it was secured in its slip. The side nearest him had a stairway leading from the rear deck to almost the waterline. Then a revelation struck him. He reached for his portable telephone and speed-dialed the Oregon. He put his hand over the mouthpiece while Hanley answered and spoke to Adams.
"They made a switch at sea," he said quickly. "I'm going to drop you back at the helicopter and then follow the signal. Call Washington and ask them to have the Danish authorities impound the vessel that just docked."
After Hanley got his orders, Cabrillo switched the telephone off, then turned the steering wheel to the locks and hit the gas. The smart car roared around in a U-turn and Cabrillo headed back up the road. Entering the airport grounds again, he pulled alongside the Robinson. Adams quickly climbed out, leaving the locator on the passenger seat.
"Get her airborne, George," Cabrillo shouted. "I'll call you."
Then he hit the gas again and began following the signal. James Bennett had learned to fly in the U.S. Army, but he had never flown a helicopter. His rating was pilot fixed wing. Because the U.S. Air Force guarded their domain carefully, he was one of the few pilots in the Army with the rating. What few fixed-wing planes the Army did have were used for observation, forward spotting, and a dozen or so corporate-type planes that were used to ferry generals around. Bennett had flown Cessna observation planes while still on active duty, so the Cessna 206 model he was flying now was old hat. Bennett had been cruising the tired old prop plane at 100 miles an hour on the flight north. Now he slowed to enter the pattern and glanced out the side window at the runway. The runway was short and ended at a rocky cliff, but that was okay. Bennett had landed on strips hacked out of jungles, tiny strips on the sides of mountains in Southeast Asia, and once in a farmer's field back home in Arkansas when he'd lost his engine. Compared to those, the airport at Faroe Islands was a piece of cake. Bennett completed his circuit and lined up for landing. Drifting down in a light wind, he ruddered the Cessna straight at the last second. The Cessna touched down with only a light chirp from the tires. Bennett slowed the plane into a fast taxi as he stared at the directions that were written on a sheet of paper on his clipboard. Then he slowed some more and turned down a side road toward a cargo terminal. In the smart car, Cabrillo had his foot to the floor. Driving the tiny vehicle was like piloting a go-kart after a pot of coffee and a half-pack of no-dos. The smart car bounced over the pavement and lurched from side to side. Cabrillo raced alongside the row of hangars and carefully watched the locator. A Cessna had just exited the runway and was taxiing along. Cabrillo stared at the plane's tail, then stopped and pulled over to check the locator. Adams had the Robinson airborne 3 minutes after he was dropped off. They hadn't even been on the ground long enough for the engine to cool off. Flying along the side of the airport, he notified the tower that he was doing an equipment test, and then he started to make low, lazy circles in the sky. The only plane visible was a Cessna that had just landed. He watched it slow to a stop in front of a hangar. Then he watched as Cabrillo in the smart car edged closer. A uniformed attendant walked out to the Cessna and shouted over the noise of the running engine,
"Are you here for the oil field parts?"
Bennett yelled back,
"Yes."
The attendant nodded and raced back through the open hangar door. A moment later, he returned with the box. Walking close to the hangar, he placed the box on the ground, then shouted in the pilot's window,
"Front or back?"
"In the front, on the passenger seat," Bennett shouted. The attendant picked up the box and walked around the rear of the Cessna. Cabrillo glanced at the gauge again. The needle was maxed out, laying against the line marked 10. He glanced up from the gauge and through the windshield just as the attendant began walking around the rear of the plane with the box. It was the same box Cabrillo had seen for a split second in Greenland. He hit the gas just as the attendant placed the box in the plane and closed the door. The Cessna started to taxi away. The plane had a head start and was about to turn onto the runway when Cabrillo reached full speed. Cabrillo steered the smart car with his knees while he reached into a holster that hung down under his arm. With his right hand, he removed a Smith & Wesson 50-caliber handgun. With his left, he rolled down the driver's window. Turning on the side road, Bennett turned to line up on the runway. Glancing to the rear, he noticed the smart car racing after him. For a second, he thought it might be the attendant chasing after him to flag him down for some reason. Then Bennett noticed a hand come out of the window with a nickel-plated revolver. Bennett advanced the throttle and pulled onto the runway, already cleared for takeoff. He took the Cessna up to safe rotation speed. It would be a close race. Cabrillo followed the Cessna onto the runway and gave chase. The plane was accelerating hard, and it was obvious the pilot was not considering stopping. As soon as Cabrillo had the smart car cruising at 50 miles an hour, he set the cruise control and slid himself through the window until he was sitting on the windowsill. Lining up his shots carefully, he began firing at the plane. Bennett heard and felt a bullet impact on his left wing strut. That was followed by the report from more bullets being fired. Reaching proper takeoff speed, he rotated by pulling back on the yoke, lifting into the air. Bennett waited until he was at 300 feet of elevation before glancing back. The smart car had stopped at the end of the runway, and the man that had been driving the car was racing toward a helicopter that had just touched down. Bennett advanced the throttle to the stops as Cabrillo climbed into the passenger seat in the Robinson. "Think you can catch him?" he shouted to Adams as he lifted off. "It'll be close," Adams said.